I'm Dave.
And I'm Rob.
We've got the same dad.
Only the problem is we didn't meet until I was about 16.
And I was 30-ish. So this is the podcast where...
we make up for lost time.
By sharing an album that your...
brother...
should... no! Fantastic. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Your Brother Should Know. On today's episode, we are going to talk about Tori Amos, Boys for Pele. So, Tori Amos, there's an artist. I'm going to start, Rob. When I said Tori Amos, what did you think?
Well, naturally, I had to reassess all my preconceptions the moment you mentioned this album as something that would be high in your Desert Island list. But yeah, Tori Amos to me is an artist I never came across. I would have probably filed her somewhere between Shania Twain and Kylie Minogue. You know, she was a slightly kooky pop presence, I imagine. Yeah, and I knew very little about her. I've maybe suspected, if anything, there's a tinge of country.
Okay. Okay. Well, if nothing else, we've probably got rid of that preconception.
We sure have.
So, as you probably now know, Tori Amos, well, she was a child prodigy, daughter of a Methodist pastor. She was the youngest ever child to enter the Peabody Institute, the famous piano conservatoire in America. However, she got kicked out at the age of 11. She says for musical insubordination.
Spiky. What happened?
Yeah, I think, she wanted to do rock and roll. And they were obviously trying to teach her classical music. And so she ran away from the conservatoire. And famously, in Tory circles, kicked around in her teenage years, her pastor father took her to, her main audience was gay bars in the 80s, apparently, where she would go and knock out her piano-based ballads to an adoring crowd. She finally landed a recording contract, but had a terrible... well, we've talked about major artists having a bad 80s. She wasn't a major artist, but she had a bad 80s. Formed a band called Why Can't Tori Read? They made one album, which I have to confess I've never heard, and I really should. But by all accounts, it's a synth rock disaster and was commercially, you know, and critically panned. But it was important for her because what it did was push her into doing, you know, the music she wanted to do rather than being pushed around by a studio. So she went away and recorded Little Earthquakes, which is the album probably most people have heard of her through because she had a couple of big hits from it. And it was, yeah, it was good. Quite a lot of orchestral arrangements, but basically piano-based ballady pop stuff with some really, really good songs on it, enough to get her out there into the world. She followed it up with Under the Pink, if you like, a slightly more quirky album, but very well received commercially and critically. And it had the big hit Cornflake Girl, probably her biggest single ever. And that's the one that most people know her through. But, in 1996...
about her deep fascination with cereal?
Well, we'll probably come on to her lyrics. Who or what is a cornflake girl? In 1996, she dropped Boys for Pele. Now, what had happened was a chap called Eric Ross, who had been her producer until then, and her romantic partner, they'd split up. And so she took herself to a church in Ireland, broke out a harpsichord, and this was the first self-produced album she made. And all of her albums have been self-produced from then on. And she made this stripped down, well, I would say masterpiece. It's a lengthy analysis of the role and position of women in relationships and religion. And it's in turn angry, visceral, sad, occasionally wryly sardonic, but mainly angry and sad. And it'd be fair to say when it came out, it polarized critics. Many people hated it. They hated the lyrics, which they thought were unfathomable and too personal. And they couldn't get on with the music either. Reviewers found it, the word you see is desolate. Rolling Stone gave it 2 stars. History's been kinder to it. It's now seen as the album that really placed Tori Amos away from, you know, yeah, she's a good pop rock star, into a serious artist in her own right. To the extent that now, you know, All Music give it 4.5 stars. They tell you it's a timeless examination of pain, self-discovery and acceptance. Others have said it's seminal in that it brought the idea of ugliness and disgust into the rock mainstream. So, quite a polarizing piece of work. As you alluded to, it's not just top 5 Desert Island disc, it's the only album probably in my collection, if someone says, right, what's your top five? It's the only album that's always on it. I don't have to think about it. This one, always. And then, you know, I know there'll be a Neil Young on it, but I don't know which one. But I always, always know this one will be on it. We'll come on to why that is later. But, Rob, having now listened to Boys for Pele by Tori Amos, what did you think?
I think I'm not wearing headphones, and we can therefore salvage all that because we can only use your take. But before we proceed, I better get some headphones.
Oh, amateurs.
Amateur hour.
Sorry.
No, that's all right.
Of course they were hiding under a theatre programme. Of course. Kind of,
hey, look at you.
Bourgeois boho I am. Right, okay.
Okay, Rob, so having now listened to Boys for Pele by Tori Amos, what did you think of it?
I can tell you that after consuming that album an inordinate amount of times over the last week or two, after my final listen on my way home to record this podcast, I had, well, having got home, I had to blast a Pearl Jam album very loud for an hour while cooking just to kind of cleanse myself a little bit. And that says more about me than Tori, I think.
So that still doesn't indicate, I can understand, I mean, you know, I love the album, and I can see why I might want to find something a bit kind of rocky and upbeat after listening to it. So did you find it took you into the long, dark tea time of the soul in a good way or a bad way? I suppose another question is it something you'd ever listen to again?
Hell yeah, in small quantities. I think we need to talk about the length of the album because it is impenetrable. I'd say I've embarked on a real journey. I think when you first mentioned you liked this album, mm-hmm. I made a tentative foray into it.
Right.
And I could tell from the get-go that this was a serious piece of work by a serious artist. And I was almost scared off it. Like, this is not something I want to listen to on my commute. This is not something I want to just kind of casually dip in and out of. And as such, I put it on a shelf and forgot about it.
Right.
Until the next time it came up and you...
I insisted upon it.
You forced me... you insisted rather than just suggesting it as a possible subject.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
At which point I made more strident efforts to consume it on morning commutes and elsewhere.
Okay.
And I definitely, again, was drawn into the gravity. But then I think repeated exposure did start to, I feel... Yeah, it's a claustrophobic album, but I also think perhaps I started to kind of glimpse a few shortfalls through the, you know, the curtains weren't quite as thick or as well fitted as I thought they were. And I started to find myself doubting my own appreciation of it.
Okay.
And now I think I'm kind of leveling out to a point where, yeah, I think there's a lot to recommend this album. I don't think it's perhaps the classic impenetrable masterpiece that I feared and expected it was when I first exposed myself to it. I think it's an interesting piece of work for sure, but I struggle to put it in my top five Desert Island Discs, but that's a whole other conversation.
Yeah, that's fair enough. You know, we can agree that it is a piece of work. It's certainly a serious piece of work. And I totally get, you know, the charge of it being dense and impenetrable is something it has to hold itself up to, because I think there are sort of barriers to its appreciation.
I mean, I'm not sure about that. I find it a very welcoming piece of music. I mean, a lot of the songs just start with unaccompanied piano, right?
And yep.
Some just stay there, and generally musical elements are brought in slowly, but none of it is... There are some moments. I guess, for example, Professional Widow mm-hmm. is a moment where you feel like the album is changing course. You've sat down, you've had three quite solemn, serious songs with different degrees of emotional intensity, but it's all quite intimate and in your eardrums, and then suddenly you have that kind of synthesized drum blaring and this thrashing harpsichord, and it sounds a little bit like you've got PJ Harvey yelling slag pit, stag shit, starfucker in your ear, and you're like, whoa, this is not the album I was sitting down to. But having said that, those moments are relatively separated, and I you know, it's not an album that instantly turns the listener off. It's not a Metal Machine music. I mean, I actually find the opening like really quite welcoming. I love that first minute or so, which was Beauty Queen, where it was just mm-hmm. like hitting a chord and holding a note, and like, to me, that is the invite. That's her kind of setting the tone, and it's almost like you need that minute to prepare yourself for the journey of Horses and then the rest of the album. And there's a famous thing where albums on ECM Records, the contemporary jazz and new music label based in mm-hmm. Germany, I guess, you know, they always start their albums with, I think it's 10 seconds of silence or so. The thought being that you press play and you sit down, you've got that moment to kind of center yourself, which is a little bit pretentious, but I don't think it's an album that immediately turns you off. I said it scared me because I could tell it was not something that I could, you know, I was not going to be bopping along on my sure. way to work listening to it. Sure. I was going to yeah. have to find a moment to open the door to it. Having yeah. said that, as I said, having, you know, repeated exposure does make you realize that it, well, we can talk about the profundity of the lyrics or not, but I think the musical ideas perhaps do become a little bit repetitive. And when you actually, there's a lot of pretty twinkly piano going on. Mm-hmm. But when you actually sit and listen, the harmonies are pretty basic, and those arpeggios are nothing really special. And anyone that plays a bit of piano, I think, would probably see through them quite quickly. So I feel like the spell was broken a little bit when I kind of forced myself to take a more analytical rather than emotional ear.
That's fair enough. And I guess for me, the spell has never been broken, but then I don't play piano, so...
Try and strum a guitar along and you'll find, you know...
I can do it. Well, that's, you know...
You'll find a lot of 1-4-5, a lot of 1-4-5s going on.
Yeah. Well, that's fine, yeah. though. And I guess one of the things I would say about the album for me is that it's the... Musically, I find it incredibly thick with ideas all the way along. And incredible, actually, that one person wrote and pretty much arranged and designed the whole thing. We talked about Supertramp last week, and that's a dense musical thing. But there's a lot of, you know, there's five people in a room trying to think through those things. You know, Tori Amos really, really did write and arrange all of this stuff. And one of the things I respond to, probably one of the major thing I respond to, and is that the musical spell has never been broken for me. So, you know, you've got an album that, yeah, at heart, there's a very strong theme of quieter, I was going to say piano ballads, but ballads is such the wrong word, isn't it? Because they're musical sketches almost, piano sketches with her.
With a few exceptions.
Yeah. But
there are a few exceptions where I think it kind of strays into, that's it. I think when it strays a bit too close to convention, perhaps, and it does perhaps undermine, I mean, it's that classic thing of perhaps an album that's too long. And I think some of the weaker material is buried a little bit.
Sure. But I guess having spent as much time with the album as I have. Okay. So in her future albums that she self-produced, I think that charge is totally, you know, has a lot of validity. I think a lot of Tory fans would wish she would sit in a room with a producer and cull her albums by a third. Apologies to those that don't agree with that. With this album, I found enough in those, even those kind of, if you like, piano sketches. You talked about Beauty Queen's Horses, which is just sustained beauty the whole way through. Hey Jupiter. I think those two just, there's not a lot going on other than just a brilliant song, if you like, for those.
So interesting. I have to interject there because, I think Horses is obviously one of the high points, not the very highest for me. But I think Jupiter's probably the song that I'm least fond of. That's the part where it becomes quite hackneyed. I mean, it's Purple Rain, basically. It's just that typical 1-6-5-4 thing. It becomes too close to a typical radio piano ballad. And that's when you start to question the other songs,
Interesting.
When it does that chorus progression, you're like, oh, she went there. Oh, okay. And look, honestly, I don't want to blame someone for writing a simple song. A lot of my favorite songs are very simple. And there's no need to be complicated. And I think what this album really rests on is, I don't think it is the relentless torrent of musical ideas as you're describing it, because I think there's no shortage of musical ideas, and there's definitely some interesting things that happen. And I love the way that she, as you say, she presents them in this off-kilter manner. I love the way that she'll play a phrase and sing along with it and then just leave a moment's silence and then just resume the next line when she feels like, in that way that only a true troubadour not playing with a rhythm section, you know, is you know, often to me it sounded like someone playing in like a dueling piano bar in the States or something, like someone like a late night entertainer, which is why this, you know, her being a gay club entertainer is really interesting to me. I didn't know that fact. That makes a lot of sense to me. I can tell that she could hold a room of rowdy drunken Irish folk or whatever and give the lip and play the songs. So the simplicity is not really here nor there. I wouldn't say there's a spouting abundance of musical ideas, but I don't think there's a dearth either. What really makes it great, surely, is just, her delivery. I mean, she's got obviously an undeniably unique voice, and she's not afraid to completely flout conventions in the way she employs it. I don't want to dwell too much on the, you know, the simplicity or otherwise of the harmony. I'm just suggesting that I feel like Jupiter was probably the song, since I mentioned it already, that where I started to, my appreciation started to crack a little bit. I think it was that cheesy chorus. It went from being a masterpiece in my mind to a great collection of songs, of which some songs are more interesting than others.
Now when I say it's fair enough, I understand what you mean, but I don't agree. and I guess for me, when it is simple, you know, and music can be simple and incredibly emotional. And I think where it is simple, it is absolutely grabbing me by heart and soul. So Hey Jupiter does that, and I know it's a simple song, but I think the song itself, the melody and the way it's delivered, is just an absolute masterpiece. No, you're right, Purple Rain would have come first.
I'm not wrong, am I?
Purple Rain. And Purple Rain's a great song, I get it. But it, that's just like literally one of the most cheesy chord progressions.
Fair enough.
Sorry, okay. But it just broke the spell. It just, I can't explain it. It just, that was the moment I was like, ooh.
So I think I want to give special mention to, because I do think it's a torrent of musical ideas. Even on the, you know, the slower piano sketches, there's always something that elevates them. So in Marianne, there's this gorgeous string break right in the middle of it in the Donut Song, which I admit is an awful song title, but the build to the last verse and the odd little keyboard coda under the whole song, I just they're the things that kind of capture your putting the damage on the horns in that are just so haunting and wonderful. So I think throughout all of those piano sketches, there's thought that's gone into how to make them just a little bit more than piano sketches. And then, as you say, combined with her ability to, and you know, when she plays live, she's the kind of performer that can hold an audience by the everything for you know, 2 hours just with her on a piano, because she's learned those tricks of the trade to do so. But I think there's little musical ideas in all of those things.
I have no doubt about that. Yeah, there mm-hmm. and I love the way the textures build, and there are these extra sounds coming in, whether they be the ridiculously cheesy brass, or you know, the tasteful strings, or the pedal steel, or just the odd distorted guitar here. But they all to me sound like almost like special effects that have been dialed for a sci-fi film later. I feel like she's written these songs alone on the piano, and she's got in and recorded these songs alone on the piano. Then she's been like, guys, what can you give me? Much as you recorded your own album and had a bunch of people come in and add bits to the songs, and she's only used a few bits she likes. I suspect that's what happened. With the exception of, and there's one thing that we can't avoid talking about, what the hell is George Porter Jr. from the Meters doing on bass? I mean, I was completely, there's a few funky songs and you know, with that uh-huh. bass, and I did kind of, when I heard them, I was like, is this like a post Seinfeld thing? Is it like a, I know funk bass was all the rage with the Chili Peppers and that in the mid 90s, I guess, but it sounded a little bit, I mean, I was digging it because, you know, it's my thing, but it sounded a little bit gratuitous on this music. Mm-hmm. Then we found out it was him, and I've got to be honest, the Meters are one of my favorite instrumental bands. That made my day, but it was also like, how did that happen? I mean, it's so incongruous to have to do a really deep, sentimental, gothic soul album and then mm-hmm. get the funkiest man alive playing the bass. But hey.
I don't know how that happened, but one of the
things. Funkiest man alive, short of George Clinton, but. Yeah.
Okay, but one of the jaw-dropping moments for me is for an album that is strong on those piano sketches, is also the amount of variety there is and the changes there are. So the, you know, like the kind of dirty, bluesy soul of Little Amsterdam. Love that. That doesn't, you know, that sort of just takes you off on a little musical journey.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously the one where you really notice Porter Jr. come in. That's a lot of fun. I kind of love-hate that song in that, it's really enjoyable, and it's a really welcome cleanser between some of the heavier material. It, you know, it breaks up. But as a result, you kind of wonder if it earned its place there, and it does stand out as a sore thumb. And look, her voice is great, and she delivers it really well, but it is, again, just a very simple kind of 1-3-4, you know, swamp blues swagger thing. The same kind of goes with Springtime of Voodoo, although I do think a lot more is going on there.
You see, for me, the reason I don't find the album too long is because the structure works.
Yeah, sure.
And maybe it's just through familiarity for me. But yeah, you know, a lot of it has a sort of, you know, somber, sad, slow piano thing, tonality. But then you've got Tallulah, In the Springtime is Voodoo, Little Amsterdam, and the three kind of little kind of vignettes, the Mr. Zebra Way Down and Agent Orange. I know when I first heard it, I was like, well, what's that about? And now I just kind of appreciate it as the arc of the album. That you know, there are moments of utter somberness that are broken up by these, not lighter, because the subject matter of, you know, Little Amsterdam is not cheerful at all. It deals with racism in the Deep South, but musically it breaks up the mood, if you like, in a way that I really appreciate.
Yeah, and so I feel like the reason that I can excuse those songs, and I do think they work into the narrative, is because there is this kind of really, yeah, say dark Southern Gothic feel. It's almost Faulkner-esque mm-hmm. on like Blood Roses. It's getting very, very, yeah. But it all fits into that, as you say, kind of New Orleans, whatever. This, again, the whole idea of this being a solo performer at a piano in some bar, giving you their life story, and some of it's dirty and bluesy and a little bit sexy, and a lot of it, you know, there's obviously lots of heartbreak and what sounds like quite a lot of violence and dark things happening, but it does sound a little bit like someone's just taken the stool at the local bar, and you know, it's kind of unfolding their life at the Keys. And so for those reasons, I do let Little Amsterdam and Springtime of Voodoo kind of sit there. I guess I'm almost feel I it's almost like I feel like I'm enjoying them too much. and that goes
you're
for
allowed
a certain...
to. You're allowed to enjoy it, even though it's basically the blues.
No, and that, you know, and Tallulah, again, I had a similar kind of feeling, and I think the fact that it comes straight after Little Amsterdam like that, right? I mean,
it's
again, that's another one that's got another one that's got those big chords. It's like DGDA, and it's this big kind of funk rocker, and it's like, to me, it felt like the girl's letting her hair down. Maybe someone brought her a shot, you know, after Little Amsterdam, and she's like, let's do another fun one. You know, it's got this arc of almost like a live set. And even the little,
in the middle of all that somnolence, you know, it's Tallulah, and then these little woos in the middle of Tallulah that just make me smile every time. It's like, what? You know, that's just fantastic. Another jaw-dropping moment is, come on, when in the history of rock and roll has the harpsichord been used to such effect? And the opening chords, first of all, to Professional Widow. I mean, I'm not the only person who's said this, but, you know, she's made harpsichord heavy metal. Those opening da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, I just can listen to, especially because it comes after Blood Roses, which is pretty visceral in itself, and that other jaw-dropping bit in the middle of Blood Roses where she changes key and does that, God knows I've thrown away those grey aces. I mean, that just knocks me out every time. And then, you said there's kind of big four songs at the beginning. They are very strong and they do grab you.
Yeah, I'd argue they're perhaps the strongest songs, and they work so well together. Like, if that was an EP, that would just be flooring you, right? And I love the way it goes, obviously, from... this, as you said, this really kind of ethereal kind of piano thing to then bringing in the harpsichord and Blood Roses, and then telling this what sounds like a very kind of sinister tale of, you know, chicken's got a taste of your meat. It's, you know, when he sucks you down deep, you're nothing but meat. You're like, wow, you know, this is when I was thinking of Faulkner.
And the famous line, there is the famous line, I've shaved every place that you've been, boy. What a line.
Yeah.
What a line.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, and then you've got Father Lucifer, which, kind of has this kind of baroque dancing piano vibe. It's got a bit of a minor kind of darkness, you know, that's clearly shadowing the really kind of charming little poppy melodies. And again, it made no sense to me. What, pizza and aeroplanes? Like, I don't know what she was on about. But the end, when her voice is like multiple voice tracked voices and it's kind of battling the
blast,
I found all that amazing. And then when Professional Widow comes in, like you say, it's like whoa. And that's and the running in the family is obviously a note that, you know, a line that everyone can just relate to, and it kind of floors you. And then you get what, Mrs. Eva, which sounds like it's like a children's song, and at that point you just get confused. I'm interested to know if there's any singles of this album. Well, there must be some singles, but
the main single was Caught a Light Sneeze.
Oh,
that's where she's done heavy metal harpsichord, and now she does pop harpsichord, and she does this fantastic pop song in the middle of it all, Caught a Light Sneeze, which is just it's a breakup song, but it's quite chirpy and it's upbeatness, you know.
Yeah.
I think the thing to say about the singles issue on this, I mean, I feel that, I don't know if it's true, but you know, she wrote this without any eye to what a single might be. And if you're a record company executive.
Oh, no doubt.
Yeah. Executive looking at this, you go, okay, Tori, where's my single? And of course, what happened is Caught a Light Sneeze was a single. It was relatively successful. But then the Professional Widow, which I, you know, think is a brilliant and strong track in itself, there was a massive dance club remix of it. I don't know if you've encountered that, by a chap called Armin van Helmond. And actually, for a lot of people, there's, you know, oh, what do you know about Tori Amos? That's what they know. They're clubbers. They thought that's Tori Amos. And there's an interesting offshoot into her sort of the next couple of albums. She does some stuff that's quite a lot in collaboration, if you like, with that kind of more electro-produced world, some of it to very good effect. But yeah, because this was quite a commercially successful album in the end, and I think it's actually got more to do with that massive dance remix anthem that Professional Widow became. In the end, they released it by taking Springtime of the Voodoo out of it and putting the Professional Widow remix into it. I have to say, being an old fuddy-duddy, I've always my nose has turned up at the Professional Widow remix. I just like, it's such a good song. How can you do that to it? But it did become a massive.
Well, you would.
It sampled that line, you know, it better be big, over and over again.
I know that. See, that's probably what I thought of her then. That's why I said somewhere between Shania Twain and Kylie Minogue or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. And really amusingly, you know the Greggs chain of bakeries in the UK? that sell kind of cheap pastries and sandwiches. Mm. They've recently started using that remix as the soundtrack to their advert.
It's got to be big.
Pastries and baguettes. It's got to be big. It's got to be big. Not knowing at all that it's from Tori Amos singing about someone's dick.
Is that what the song's about?
Oh, what do you think?
can we say that on a Spotify or wherever this is going to end up?
We have done now. So maybe that brings us gracefully onto the issue of the lyrics.
Okay, so we've got big dicks. What else is she singing about? Thanks for breaking that to me, Dave. I was leaving it to the imagination.
I know. The thing that drew me into this album was the music. To the extent that I actually think if all she was singing was la, 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 la lyrically, I think, I don't know whether I would, but I like to think I still love it because I do find it.
Really?
The music so compelling. Yeah. The lyrics I do understand are, there's a lot of metaphors and kind of in jokes for her, if you like, or things that make sense for her that clearly aren't that universal. I find, though, she kind of almost in every song drops in something that tells you what it's about or allows you in, and then you engage with the metaphors as you will. And I thought about this a lot in contrast to the Fetch the Bolt Cutters and Fiona Apple last podcast, because I really couldn't get on with that. And in a way, I wondered if it's because...
We're not doing that classic male thing of playing powerful women against each other, are we?
No, we're absolutely not. No. And it's an interesting... Well, there's a whole different debate there, because the other thing that people do around Tori Amos is they dismiss her as, oh, she's just like Kate Bush, which I find really insulting on every single level. It's like, what, just because she's female and writes songs on the piano, you know, I just find it cheating dismissal. But I think there is a valid discussion to be had about, look, here, you know, you've pitched me Fiona Apple and I really couldn't get on with it, despite the fact that you could see some passing similarities between the approach to music of Tori Amos and Fiona Apple. You know, they're both classically trained pianists. They both sing very much from their soul and heart, and they both are at least attempting to do things that are outside of the pop and rock mainstream, right? So I can see enough to at least make me ask myself the question, well, why do I engage with this and not with the Fiona Apple's work? Does that make sense?
Because you heard it when you were 30 years younger?
Could be that. Or is it that I think with the Fiona Apple stuff, it was almost too direct about her life, which was very different to mine, and therefore I couldn't find an in. So possibly with this album, the fact that a lot of the lyrics, I'm not entirely sure what she's on about, really, really helps. Mm. Especially as in each song, there seems to be a couple of lines that just give you enough of a clue and really do draw you in. So for instance, that line we've already mentioned about...
It being big.
You know, I've shaved every place that you've been, boy. Now, that feels like it's sung from a very female perspective, but that idea of cleansing yourself from a relationship, that's what I take from it. I absolutely get that. And then there's some more, you know, lots, much more direct things like, you know, caught a light sneeze, didn't know our love was so small, couldn't stand at all. I think we can all make sense of that. In Jupiter, it's really direct, you know, nothing's been the same. So are you gay? Are you blue? Thought we both could use a friend to run to. I thought I wouldn't have to be with you, a magazine. Now, some of these, so within all of the kind of more flowery metaphor lyrics, there are some really direct statements that draw you in and in putting the damage on. I'm trying not to move. It's just your ghost moving through. You know, you don't have to think too hard to know what that's about. So go on.
Well, I was going to say, is it in your estimation, roughly how much of this would you say was Boy Trouble? Is this a classic breakup album in your book? Or?
Well, yeah, no, I think, the clue's in the title, Boys for Pele, is basically about the legend in Hawaiian Islands of sacrificing men to a volcano. and it clearly is written on the back of her breaking up with her, you know, former producer, Eric Ross. So the songs to me are generally about loss, and generally it's about loss of your romantic partner, and from quite an empowering perspective. So mostly they're about, look, that's awful, but I'm going to get over it. You know, the very closing track, Twinkle, it's so hard, but I know a girl twice as hard. And again, that's a lyric that I'm not a girl, but I can certainly relate to and understand, you know, keep going kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So yeah, a lot of the songs are about romance that has gone wrong, but then they're also about kind of, you know, and a recurring theme in Tori Amos's work, possibly vis-a-vis her dad, who's a Methodist pastor, kind of religion and specifically the sort of patriarchal nature of religion and women's position in it. You know, I suppose most obviously in Muhammad, My Friend, it's time to tell the world, we both know it was a girl back in Bethlehem, which is...
Well, that was the line I was about to bring up, because surely that if...
Yeah.
You know, if this album had been published in the internet era, if it had been published this today, that would be making headlines, right? What do you make of it? What's your
choice? Yeah, I personally don't make any other than, yeah, good point, Tori. Could well have been. And, well, that's if you, you know, buy into religion in the first place. But, you know, there's no doubt that organized religion has been pretty male dominated. Stories for men, made for men to control other men and women, is my humble opinion. And I think Tori gets to the heart of that sometimes. And, I think the song sort of, you know, come on guys, you know, it was a girl anyway. That's quite amusing, actually. But yeah, where did the lyrics leave you? I guess because it's one of the things when it first came out, the reviews were absolutely one of the reasons why no one could get on with this album, because the lyrics are just too up themselves, if you like.
I found the lyrics pretty impenetrable on a casual listening, and even reading into mm-hmm. them briefly, there was not a lot of really apparent meaning, which I certainly don't object to. And as you say, I think some of the most powerful songs can be those that can be interpreted however you want. There were some images that are really powerful. I mean, I love the idea of eating the middle of a donut. You know, I presume that that's I imagine that's a comment on, you know, the male gaze and the pressures of being a woman potentially. I don't know. Or I didn't try and unpack them too much. There wasn't really anything for me to grasp onto, but a general mood of seriousness. And I respected that mood mm-hmm. of seriousness and suspected that a genuine statement was being made. And I did like, because I say, this kind of tragic gothic southern vibe, which sounded quite cinematic at times. Definitely felt like you're inhabiting a worldview in the same way that if you, you know, an album is a collection of songs and they can be about lots of different things, but there are certain artists that do, certainly have an album or even a career, paint a kind of consistent milieu. And I think Tom Waits is a really obvious example of that, or perhaps Lou Reed, or mm-hmm. and I felt like these songs all felt like they're written about by the same person at the same time, possibly about the same place, even the same town or whatever, you know. And that to me is quite appealing. I like the sense of it being an authentic statement that's talking about a real place that the writer can not just relate to, but distill the essence of in a way that people who have never been there or don't even know where there is geographically, emotionally, in any sense, can get something from, which is clearly what you've done.
Yeah, no, I mean, and ultimately, I guess the key thing the album is about, like 80-90% of all pop rock and roll is it's about the fact that
sex
a relationship broke down and this is Tori Amos coming to terms with it. And from the very beginning, you know, the first lyrics are, I've got me some horses, not I've got some samosas, as some people have misheard it. I've got me some horses to ride on, and it's about, you know, I'm riding out of this awful, you know, sad situation. And it closes with, I know it, you know, as I said, it's hard, but I know a girl twice as hard. So she explores all of the feelings that those breakdowns in relationships have left her, and takes a slight sidestep, well, a related sidestep into kind of her role in the patriarchy, and ends up, I think, well, for me, these two albums, Disintegration by The Cure and this one, ends up kind of resolving themselves around that and getting back on with your life, but acknowledging that pain is still there. And I think both those albums in different ways do that. It's the same kind of lyrical narrative, if you like. So, I guess I'm right in some, I mean, actually, Rob, you're liking this album more than I expected then, in that you've clearly highlighted that you think there's a lot of strengths to it. And, you know, you hold up the charge that it could have done with some editing, but there's a lot of strengths to it. Given all of that, where do you think the best place to listen to this album would be?
As I was just saying, it does really paint this kind of southern vibe and very cinematic, so I can't help but getting a picture of me like sitting on like a, you know, a porch in, you know, the mudlands of Mississippi as the sun goes down, probably some cheap bourbon, a shotgun as is pictured on the cover, maybe, you know, sitting by the door. That's a little bit of a hick fantasy. The truth is, I'd like to hear these songs sung in that little fictional neighborhood tavern. I want to hear her singing them at a piano and bringing them to life. And I know, saying, of course, we'd always rather hear the album played live, fine. But, you know, I feel like this is a Dark Night of the Soul album, but it's also quite redemptive. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it could be quite powerful to hear it publicly. And I definitely feel like this would be one that would work in that environment. Or maybe the gay clubs that she used to play. You know, I feel like it's quite theatrical music, and I think it's quite performative music. Mm-hmm. It definitely would probably go well with a bourbon on the rocks.
Sounds good.
So I've got to ask, David, you alluded to it earlier, how this and Disintegration, you know, a particular albums have clearly helped you through some dark times. So at what point in your life did you first encounter this? What role did it play? How did you come to kind of love and really appreciate this album as much as you do?
This came to me actually
the part of the show where we get a bit sentimental.
I know. It came to me 3 or 4 years after Disintegration, post-uni. A friend of mine was really into the first two Tori Amos albums, and I have to admit, I've got into them
subsequently. Which came out in the early 90s? I guess.
Yeah, 1993-ish or something. And I wasn't a big Tory fan, but he couldn't get on with this album at all, so gave me the CD. And about that time, I had just bought a camper van those are the days when you could live in a camper van for 2 summers and save up enough money for a deposit on a flat in London. So that's what I was doing. I bought a camper van and was living in it I went in for the winter, as it were, but in the summers I stayed in a camper van. And the two main tapes I had was this one, and the other one was Recovering the Satellites by Counting Crows. So possibly... Blimey. One of the reasons that I love this album so much is because it was all that Counting Crows is all
the
I had.
Only entertainment you had for 2 years or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And I would spend evenings on my own in my van in a campsite, listening to this and cooking my lonely supper, overlooking Hackney Marshes. So not very. When it was the Deep South, it was sort of South East London.
Well, why would you ever want to listen to this album again? That sounds tragic.
You
must be bloody sick of it, and it must remind you of a really sounds like quite a bleak time.
The thing to say, of course, is, you know, as will be no surprise, because I was living in a camper van, I'd broken up from a long-term girlfriend as well, obviously, it served as a salve and a sticking plaster for that as well. But that's when I first encountered it. And
how long are you in the camper van for?
Just 2 summers. Although, as you know, any of my friends listen to this, they'll be like, yeah, Dave, you said you're in the camper van, but you spent a lot of time sleeping on our sofas while the camper van was parked in the street. But in those days, you know, you only needed to save about 3 or 4 months' rent over 2 years, and that was enough money for a deposit on a flat. So that's what I did.
Wow. The moral of this story, boys and girls, is...
If you want to appreciate...
Suffer now. Suffer now in order that you can be... comfortable later.
There you go. Right, we've gone vaguely from Tori Amos's Boys to Pele to my pension plan, so let's skirt over that. But I have continued to enjoy, and it's not an album that I put on to do the washing up, or indeed it's never made it to a barbecue playlist, but it's probably occupies a similar space to Disintegration, those two albums. And don't worry, they're the two long, particularly somber breakup albums that I appreciate. And from this point in, everything else is going to be really short and cheerful.
I was going to say, so I really thank you for picking them among the first 3 or 4 we've done now. Honestly, it's clearly a monumental work by, major talent. What do I hear next?
Yeah, I mean, this was my entry into Tori Amos, had become one of my favourite artists now. So I've come to really love Little Earthquakes and Under the Pink, which are the two albums that preceded it. They're a little bit more accessible, if you like, in inverted commas, but the more you listen to them, the more you realise there's an awful lot of strength to them. They were followed up by From the Quiet Girl, Hotel, and To Venus and Back, and To Venus and Back especially, or was it just Venus and Back? I can't remember. That's a double album. One side of it's one half, it's a live album, and the other half was going to be an EP, but it spread out. And there she does dabble more in, you know, because up till then she'd really, you know, mainly done, you know, real acoustic instruments, if you like, and she dabbles more in electronica there, I think, to some pretty stunning effects. So they're good. And then a couple of years later, she did Scarlet's Walk, which is right back into her and a piano mainly. And I really love that album. That's my second favourite Tori album. It's a kind of almost, if you like, a mature, reflective version of this. So it's like, what did Tori do when she grew up? I think she did Scarlet's Walk. After that, and apologies to Tori fans, there's an album called Beekeeper, which I found was too middle of the road. And yeah, that kind of thing where you need a producer to tell you to have 20 minutes less on an album was very needed. bit of return to form with American Doll Posse, which has a lot of different styles to it, which I really enjoy. But that was probably the last album of hers that I really enjoyed. There's, you know, I won't list them. There's about six or seven albums after that. I find them more in the Beekeeper. They're nice middle of the road piano songs, but they're just that I found she's lost. That's an awful thing to say, but she's lost her soul for me in those later albums. But I think she's a proper artist.
Evidently.
And I think basically her first six or seven albums is what shows that.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a real body of work there. There's some strength. Okay. So thank you, Rob, for that. You made me think about that album more and more than I have done. Cause you know, you're into an album. You don't even necessarily think about it, but that Southern Gothic thing is interesting. It is writ large all over it. So thank you very much for your thoughtful approach to listening to Boys for Pelé by Tori Amos. What will I be trying to bring my thoughtful approach to next time?
I think it's time for us to do some good old rock and roll and fumble towards the closest thing to a zeitgeist we're going to find in this day and age. There's a lot of hoo-ha right now about the fact Rolling Stones just were about to release their first album in 18 years. I can't say I'm very excited about it, but weirdly, 18 years ago, I was quite excited about its predecessor and spent far too much time listening to it. I hope it's half as musically meritful as I recall it, but we're going to find out together. Let's go and listen to A Bigger Bang. The Rolling Stones' only recorded album at the time of speaking in the last 25 years?
Yeah, something like that.
Album of original studio material.
Okay, well, that would be really interesting.
You don't look so thrilled. You don't look so thrilled.
No, I am. No, sorry, I am thrilled because, as you know, because we've talked about, you know, I love the Stones, but I probably stopped listening to the Stones in 1974. So that's going to be interesting to see what the Stones did when they grew up.
Exactly.
Or did they just get old? There you go. Fantastic. Thank you, Rob. I look forward to that. Thanks for listening, everybody. See you next time.